Welcome back to the Scaling Tech Podcast, the podcast for leaders of growing software engineering teams. I'm your host, Aaron Sahn, and today I'm trying out a new format. If you've listened to past episodes of the Scaling Tech Podcast, then the biggest change is that going forward, I'll be the only host of the Scaling Tech Podcast. My friend, colleague, and business partner, David Alfaro, is moving his focus to other parts of the business, so I'll take on all the hosting duties going forward. I'm really grateful for David's contributions to the Scaling Tech Podcast to date and all the other adventures he and I have shared together over the last decade plus. So thank you, David. I'm also going to make a few other smaller changes to the podcast going forward. We'll try to keep the episodes a little more bite-sized, more in the 30 to 45 minute time frame instead of hour long. I think that's a good time frame to help make sure that my guests and I are delivering value to you in more discrete chunks, which is very agile, right? So we're going to also start posting more snippets from each episode so that you can consume those delicious bite-sized chunks of value in whatever platform you choose. So please make sure to hit the like or subscribe button on whatever podcast platform you're listening to this episode, as well as on our YouTube and LinkedIn pages. We'll also continue to post show notes and links on scalingtechpod.com for each episode. So you can go there to join our email list, as well as to suggest topics and guests. So thank you to everyone who's been a listener of this podcast to date. I hope you'll continue to join me on this next phase of our journey together, where we continue to learn about the technologies and management skills that every engineering manager needs to know. All right, let's get on to today's interview with David Ash about the Agile Enterprise. David Ash produced robust enterprise software as a service, cloud-based products in all his managerial positions throughout a 36-year career. He introduced agile philosophy and methodologies to each of his companies, enabling his teams to meet their goals. Ash currently owns and operates 10X Principles, a management organizational consulting company that helps technology companies navigate the transition from startup to mid-stage. During this time of rapid growth and change, teams typically find that the wearing many hats behavior from their startup days is no longer the best approach to honoring commitments. Ash helps these companies weave agile practices into the fabric of their cultures, and he's also author of The Agile Enterprise from Business Expert Press. Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, David.
Thank you, Aaron. Nice to be here.
It's a pleasure to be here with you. It's great to see you again. So let's start with a really important question here, I think, and related to your book. Why is Agile still relevant in the enterprise? Isn't everyone Agile now?
I think you're coming in with fighting words, Aaron. everyone says they're Agile, and who doesn't want to be
right.
Agile? Agile is a great word, and whatever marketing team kind of brought that into the fore was brilliant.
Right.
So, everybody says they're Agile. Everybody wants to be Agile. But I think in practice, really very few are. And, Agile was designed for engineering teams primarily. And many of them are Agile-ish. And nobody sort of follows a methodology to the T or to the letter, and nor should
right.
they.
Right.
But in a lot of ways, Agile has not really, the concept of Agile is applicable widely. And I think very few companies are truly Agile.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I mean, it's fighting words, I suppose, right? It kind of makes me think back to, over my career working with Agile methods, which is around 20 years now, thinking that someday Agile should be so normal in the way that we work that we don't even use the word anymore. It's just how software is built. It's
right.
just how we do work, right? And kind of like, I think it's analogous a little bit to the way that the term AI is overused and everything right now. And then also gets misused. And when things go wrong, things get blamed as, inappropriately blamed. Well, we tried Agile, but it didn't work for us for whatever reason. And that's Agile's fault, not the fact that we weren't actually doing anything about Agile to begin with, right? So I think, and in a way, maybe even that is a sign of maturity that it is getting inappropriately blamed at times.
It is for sure. And I think part of, I blame the methodologies in a lot of ways. I think the Agile Manifesto is a pretty pure thing. And it's an argument, about collaboration and about sort of taking small bites and about this idea of delivering something of value over kind of extensive planning. It all makes intuitive sense to just about everybody who hears it. And you know, the thing about a philosophy is just that philosophies don't come with rule books, and you know, they're kind of vague by design. And so that's where the methodology sort of industry has kind of come to the fore. We'll give you something that will show you how to operationalize Agile. And that, you know, so people know sprints and they know retrospectives and they know story points and they know pair programming and they know Kanban and they learn all these things. And you know, sometimes interestingly, the whole methodology kind of refutes one of the tenets of Agile, that it's really communication over process. Not that process isn't important, but kind of interpersonal communication comes first. And a lot of groups get wrapped up in kind of the you know, the mechanics of how do we make Agile work and how does a sprint run and, you know, what do we do with our backlog and, you know, all those things that kind of abstract away from the core principles of the idea.
Yeah, I agree completely. I mean, I've always thought of the Agile Manifesto as a really good set of guardrails, and kind of what is, you know, a bit of the genius, but maybe also you could argue like a weak spot in the sense of it doesn't tell you exactly what to do. It doesn't say that this is the method above all others by design. But it gives you these really great set of guardrails that you should work within.
Yeah,
right.
Indeed.
And, you know, when you talk about like, and it like collaboration over contract negotiation and completing software over documentation, those sorts of things. It's, you know, it's always, well, it's not that contracts aren't necessary. They're That's very right. necessary, unfortunately, right? But we should be more focused on how do we create a relationship between, you know, supplier and the company, between remote development teams, that's based on collaboration rather than going back to change documents and old requirements documents and stuff like that.
Right.
And so, yeah, you can do a lot of things and call it Agile, and that's the pro and the con of using a term like Agile. But I always say to people, like, you know, you can do anything you want. I don't care if you call it Scrum or Kanban or Scrumban or whatever. But whenever you make a change, go back to that manifesto and think about those principles. Are you operating within those guardrails? And if you're not, that's where you need to question, are you really doing, you know, Agile? And why are you making this change if it doesn't sort of fit within those guardrails?
Right. I agree with that. And I think one of the key points you make is that in the manifesto, it's communication over process or you know, just you customer involvement over a contract. It's not that one precludes the other. It's just that
right.
you favor one over the other.
And, exactly.
And I think that gets lost a lot of times when you know, a lot of people who you know, kind of denigrate Agile say, oh, well, Agile is so loosey-goosey. You don't have to do any planning. You don't have to do anything. And, you know, in reality, software is hard to build no matter what. And
yeah.
it's not like you can build it without planning and without forethought and without all of these things. And, you know, in a lot of ways, groups need to kind of understand that. And even if a methodology they're using doesn't necessarily allow for, you know, a long period of discovery, that has to be built in somehow.
Right.
And
right.
Whether or not it fits in a sprint or not, or whether you have a retrospective after it, that's kind of beside the point.
Yeah, I think it, you know, they're good guidelines to follow. Again, it's kind of like, well, you know, why, you know, you say like, you know, whether or not it fits within the sprint. Okay, well, if we're saying, okay, our user stories don't fit within the sprint, and that's okay, but we're still Agile. You know, I think those sorts of, anytime you want to change the rules, essentially, if you're following like in that, you know, we would be talking about a Scrum team, presumably. It's like, well, why are you changing? You know, why are you saying it's okay for a story to be bigger than the sprint? You know, what's the motivation beyond that? And
right.
it is, and that's where it goes back to like the Agile Manifesto, right? Are we just saying that because, well, you know, our contract said we had to work on this thing and we don't want to break it down further, or our original, you know, Gantt chart plan said we were going to do this thing now. And so we have to just put it in the sprint and let's not bother breaking it into small pieces, right? That's not agile, right? You're favoring contract negotiation and following a plan over responding to change and, you know, working in small deliverable chunks, right? Now, on the other hand, if it's, you know, there's some other reason, maybe some other unique technical reason, it's an exception to the rule, then, you know, fine, I suppose, right? But like, you always have to gut check yourself.
That's right.
I think is key.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And, you know, one thing to keep in mind is that the guys who sort of penned the Agile Manifesto were really just kind of codifying their style of work that they were probably already doing. These guys were pros. And so they said, well, what's a better way than kind of this waterfallish thing that was sort of based on manufacturing or based on construction projects?
Absolutely. Now, unfortunately, neither one of us were there at the crafting of the Agile Manifesto. So we all have a kind of our own story of how we came into this and how it interested us. What initially made you interested in Agile methods? And in particular, I'd love to hear too about applying those methods outside of only software development teams.
Sure, sure. So, I mean, I think my history is primarily as an engineering manager and somebody who's really kind of been on the hook to deliver software that solved customers' problems. And I learned about Agile pretty early in my career just because things happened to dovetail that way. And what I found was that really delivering small chunks of functionality actually worked. It wasn't always easy to do, and it's not easy. It's hard to do that. And more so to deliver something that actually is of value to users and listening to them and understanding what it is. So I kind of had a long career doing Agile and introducing it at various places. And I found that you know, there are really interesting ways to deal with it. Like in one circumstance, I worked at a company where I had a team that was in India and a large team. And we weren't really being very effective communicating back and forth. And they didn't, you know, what I discovered is they didn't really have enough autonomy, in part because they weren't trusted to have enough autonomy. And so they needed to have a way of kind of owning their own piece of things. At the same time, providing enough transparency so that the other side in the United States could kind of figure out how things were going to fit together. So it was really an interesting education for me in how teaching another team about this would really be valuable. And so what I found is that when I started my consulting company, the reason I started it was just because, you know, what I've recognized is kind of a pathology, a corporate pathology, is that as companies grow and as they hit certain inflection points, there are stresses that come in that kind of change how companies need to work. And so, for example, moving from a startup to a mid-stage company involves more hiring and more this and more that. And often a lot of the cohesion that existed in a startup to keep things together and keep everybody kind of pushing in the same direction kind of gets lost in some ways. And important things get tossed on the floor sometimes. And so I found that focusing on some of those areas of stress was valuable. And in many of the consulting companies, or many of the customers that I've dealt with in my consulting, have enabled me to kind of try out Agile ideas across the company. I've found that it has really worked interestingly and well, and people have intuitively flocked to it. And I don't use any of the Agile buzzwords when I'm dealing with them. It's really just a matter of, well, how do we break this big thing? For example, I was working with an HR team who came into money and needed to hire a bunch of people. And you know, it started out, well, we just need to hire a bunch of people. So at the end of 6 months, we'll have all of our people in place, and we'll just work, you know, night and day until we make that happen. And, you know, the problem with an approach like that is, well, all right, you know, you can kill yourself working to do it, but it needs to be chunked a little bit better, and it needs to be kind of thought through a little bit more carefully. And there are aspects of this that the HR team wasn't really thinking about, like how are you going to track candidates, and how are you going to communicate properly with them? How are you even going to vet them? And so things like that, and how do we measure our progress along the way of hiring? And so it's not that you come out in the end any different necessarily. You still need to hire the same people in the end. But the question is, if you can chunk it and kind of assess how you're doing at each point along the way, you kind of know how much trouble you're in or how well you're doing as you go. And, you know, one of the really interesting things that I discovered along the way is that as a team was assembled to hire, and it involved people from different departments who were hiring managers, they started taking ownership of this process and saying, well, hey, you know, the problem we're having here is that we've made bad hires in the past. And the reason we've made bad hires is we had this interview process where we do a lot of talking with candidates, and then they didn't pan out in the end when we hired them. And they said, you know, the problem is that we're hiring the best actors. And I was thinking, well, yeah, if Meryl Streep were to interview for a coding position, you know, she's a pretty polished and classically trained actress. She would learn what it would take to win a job in a computing company, you know, as a programmer. But she'd probably write spaghetti code when you got her in place. So you really want to try out somebody. And you know, I've gone through the process of giving kind of take-home exams to people, and where they are asked to do a chunk of work for you and then deliver it. And you know, that's a difficult thing. And what I found that was just much more effective is to really audition candidates and have them work with either one or two people to see how they would work in a collaborative environment on whatever the problem is. And it's not just a programming problem, but it could be a marketing issue. It could be a product issue. It could be anything, really. But what the team agreed on is that whatever issues we give to these people, they should be real things that we're trying to answer. We shouldn't Right. necessarily have the answers ourselves, and we're looking to them. How can they lead us? How can they be led? And all of those things. And what they found is that they were able to get really good candidates, the people who sort of they felt they would want to work with on a day-to-day turned out to be really good employees. And it was just a matter of kind of managing this in a way and kind of paying some attention to it, you know, because one of the things with hiring is that people who need to hire the most tend to be the busiest, and it's hard to take their time. So there needed to be a Right. triage process up front where skilled people who weren't necessarily the hiring managers could actually assess candidates up front. So it was really just taking a big problem that this company had and compressing it into actionable pieces along the way and with metrics in place to figure it out. So
even though it's, you know, your background like mine is in engineering management, and so taking those same principles of working in small chunks and delivering value and applying that to the hiring process around the team. So not just, you know, how the team performs its work, but also how you bring people in to the team, how you integrate them in, how you interview for them,
right?
That sort of thing.
Right.
I like it.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, it's like solving a technical problem.
Sure.
You know, in some ways, the company had to articulate, well, what's important to us? What are we really hiring for? Are we hiring for cultural fit? Are we hiring for this or that? And you know, that's kind of the discovery work that needed to happen. You know, they needed to answer, well, who is an ideal candidate for us? And what are their qualities? And what should we be looking for? And if somebody is actually in a role who's not the hiring manager, who needs to assess candidates, what should they be looking for, and how do we agree on these things? And you know, in some ways, it's sort of like figuring out, you know, what is the customer's real problem that they need to solve, and how are we going to go about doing that?
Yeah, I like how you talked about how you mentioned that, you know, when you're talking to people outside of the team, you're not using a lot of fancy agile terminology, even though you're trying to apply some of the same principles. And I think that's really, you know, important. And it makes me think too about, you know, when you're talking about applying agile principles or more broadly, let's just say lean, you know, management to things outside of software development. You know, you definitely see it. This is an area where you notice differences between different agile methodologies, right? Scrum is very much geared around software development. The terminology right. of it, the rituals, the different meetings are all really geared towards a software development team. I think in a lot of cases, harder to apply to a non-software problem or team. Whereas Kanban is a very generic process that, you know, really comes from auto manufacturing,
right?
You know, comes from Toyota and lean manufacturing, and is less prescriptive in how you work and the way you structure things. And so, you know, applicable to a wider audience. Although even there, you know, you could maybe overwhelm the HR group if you're trying to put in every, you know, Japanese Kanban term into the process. But if you just take those basic principles of
right.
visibility
yep.
and measuring flow through the system, then
right.
boom, you're agile.
And in fact, they used a Kanban board for this. And,
perfect.
And I think they used Trello. And the thing about it is that it really worked perfectly for them. It enabled everybody on the team to communicate through the cards and move them over and shuffle them around and do all of that without ever really uttering anything about Agile.
Right.
They were doing Agile without really realizing that they were doing that. So it's a beautiful thing.
Can you give us another example of applying Agile outside of a software development team?
Well, do you want to talk about sales or?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's talk about sales.
So sales seems like one of these deals where, all right, so either you make the sale or you don't make the sale. What's agile
right.
about that? And, you know, the other thing about sales is that sales has kind of can have a terrifically long and unpredictable sales cycle.
Yeah.
Depending on if you're doing enterprise sales or other kinds of sales, there, you know, the relationships have to be cultivated and other things need to kind of be put in place. But when you think about sales kind of at a more macro level, the thing about it is that sales is really consequential, and a sales forecast is probably the most consequential document a company can deliver because it affects everything. It affects hiring, it affects bonuses, it affects kind of targets, it affects capital spending, it affects just about everything. And the way these things are often done is that a head of sales and a CFO may huddle together in Q4 or Q3 of the previous year and put together this forecast and deliver it. And then all kinds of decisions are made based on that, about all those things I just mentioned. And the thing about it is that invariably that sales forecast is wrong.
Right.
You know, just how wrong it is, it's probably really wrong because things happen. And it's one of these things that lends itself to an agile process in that continuing to revisit that sales forecast on a regular basis and updating it and modifying it and keeping in mind what the original goals were is really important. And you know, the thing is, if something accelerates in a sales process, you know, and your forecast was too conservative, that's a bad thing. If something that was regarded as a sure deal falls through, that can be a devastating thing. And by paying close, tight attention to these things, it really does allow a company to be more nimble in terms of how it does things. And so in terms of hiring, for example, if things aren't going quite the way you expect them to do, you find out early on and you hold back on hiring and you you kind of manage to where you're at a given time. And just like a software project, as time moves forward in a sales process, there's more clarity about what's going to close and what's not going to close, and you can take actions, you know, appropriately based on that. So that's sort of, I think, how sales can be agile in kind of a big way. I think in a small way, I think sales groups are already doing this, where they kind of are tracking. I mean, sales is probably the best at metrics, because they sort of can, you know, they kind of have built-in hard metrics about the number of meetings they have, about the number of conversions from pilot to close they have, you know, all those kinds of things that they do keep very good track of. And I think salespeople are often judged by how many of these meetings they have and how many calls they have and how many of this and that they've done. So in that sense, I think that process is actually can be chunked into small things, rather than just we have this pipeline and you know, we think these are sure things and this is what our number is going to look like.
That's exactly what I wanted to ask you about and kind of drill into a little bit more is how you break things down into smaller chunks, right? Into smaller bites in software development. It seems easier to me in a way, right? We can just build part of this feature and call that fully done and release it to a customer and call it value. But you know, maybe that's just my bias coming from a development background, right? It's a little bit harder for me to look at a sales process or an HR process and say, how do you break that down into smaller chunks? So how do you do that? Is it all about those kind of like leading indicator metrics?
Well, I think it's about, I think it's about metrics, and it's really just about kind of recognizing where in the process every opportunity is and kind of managing to that and, you know, kind of understanding that this opportunity is this far away and these are the things that actually need to happen before that's going to become real. We need to cultivate this relationship. We need to provide some sort of demonstration of something to them. We need to keep them warm, and we need to, you know, continue to kind of manage to that. It seems like there are, in terms of the phases to get to this big thing that, you know, if you think the sale is the thing, I think there really are ways to chunk up that whole process, and there really are well-defined stages. Just because most sales of any big size don't just happen. They happen over some span of time that right. can be managed to. I think really in some ways, good sales teams are already kind of could be the most agile in a company if they're sort of looking at things that way.
Right. Well, they're arguably judged the most harshly against the value that they deliver. Right?
Yeah.
And the value they deliver is very quantifiable.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. But you know, another thing about these big sales kind of forecasts is that, you know, a lot of bonus plans are based on sales numbers, and lots of companies say, well, your bonus is paid based on your own personal performance along with company performance, and you know we manage these two together and all of that. But the problem is then employees are given objectives that are important at the time, and as managers we know kind of sometimes at the end of the year when you're looking at objectives, they're no longer important to the company. It's sort of like a waterfall process where you're designing something and you take so long to design it, by the time it's designed, it's obsolete. And that's what kind of happens to objectives that are treated that way, that are based on this is what we're going to sell and this is who we're going to sell to. And therefore, these are the most important things to our company. And, you know, I think what it is it's an argument for revisiting objectives and revisiting bonus plans and revisiting these things on you know much more frequent than an annual basis.
Absolutely. And we could do a whole another separate episode just about compensation in an agile context and what does that mean, and there's varying opinions on that. we'll have to be careful about going down that rabbit hole now, but there's a lot to consider there. Sure. Because you can, you know, in any process where people are judged by any form of metric, they're going to gear their behavior to that a little bit. So I like what you say about, you know, like in a sales context, yes, they're going to be judged on certain goals and their pay is going to be tied to that. But we do still need to keep in mind the bigger objective of what we're trying to do and, you know, who and how we're selling, because that's really important, just like in a software development project, right? If I'm a,
yeah,
if I'm a product owner type or a requirements analyst in a more traditional or larger structure, and all I'm judged on is, did I produce a pretty requirements document?
Right.
But that doesn't actually relate to value delivered to customers. Then, you know, I'm not really being judged on what the company's objective is are we delivering value to our customers and, you know, improving customer loyalty and all these other things, not, you know, writing a pretty document. Right. So yeah, it's, we have to balance all those things against each other for sure. You know, I think it's for me, a key aspect of applying Agile to anything outside of software development is that we have to have this flexibility and leave space for, you know, changing and removing a lot of things from the process. Like I would say, you know, estimation, at least, you know, is depending on the process you're measuring, may or may not make sense, right? Scrum kind of requires it, Kanban doesn't. But if Agile is really nothing more than are we making our work visible, you know, on a board of some kind, for example, is it visible? Is it prioritized? And then we're just treating it like a very visible and highly prioritized to-do list. Well, we could do that with anything. We could do that with, you know, our chores at home. We could do that with a sales process. We could do that with financial processes, right? All sorts of things, right?
You could
That's all it is.
You could have written this book, Aaron.
Well, it would have been too short if I said, here's all you need to do. I mean, I always joke when I teach classes on Agile, there's a day-long seminar that I still do through the University of Virginia. And I usually start off with this lesson about basically saying what I just said, like, you know, make your work visible, make it highly prioritized, and then go through that list of prioritized work as fast as possible. And this is now, you know, maybe 15 minutes into an 8-hour day. And I've said, if you can just remember those, you can tune out the rest of the day. The next 7.5 hours don't matter. If you go back to your work and you make it more visible and more prioritized, you're being pretty agile, right? That's probably an improvement over what you're doing right now.
Right. Yeah, indeed, it is.
Would you say, is there anything that you cannot make agile in a company?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing is I'm not an agile zealot. I do a little, I denigrate waterfall in my book. I have a section.
Well deserved.
I have a section where I think I titled it something like, waterfall, oh waterfall, how do I hate thee? Let me count the ways.
Right.
But the thing is that sometimes there are things that one needs to do that aren't agile. So for example, suppose you're writing a website for supermarket e-commerce. You have a grocery store and you're building something from scratch that customers want to, you know, buy groceries. That's a big, complicated piece of software that one is undertaking. And it's not just that you can say, well, hey, let's start with our shopping cart and let's just work on that and deliver some functionality. You know, somebody might need to envision, well, how's this website going to look? What are the components of it? How are they going to snap together in the end? What does this thing really look like? And that is, you know, one of these things where somebody could say, well, that's where waterfall is good, because you are taking a big look at things and kind of working through that. And you know, my response is that you know, some, it's like throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Waterfall has its merits in that it, you know, things don't get dropped on the floor so much because you're taking a good hard look at a problem. On the other hand, you're probably taking too hard a look at the problem and that you're figuring out things, right, that don't need to be figured out. But in this supermarket example, one would need to figure out, well, what are the components of this thing? What are the big pieces of this? How are these things going to work together? And what's the, you know, what's the framework that they're kind of all snapping into? And if you have multiple teams doing multiple pieces of this, how are they all going to work together? And what are the contracts between them? And how do you know if what, if they finish at different times, how are we going to make that work? So that's really kind of a discovery process, I think. So I don't really call it a waterfall process, but it's a process that's not bound by a 2-week sprint necessarily. It's a process that is sort of undertaken by experts, either people who kind of technically are experts or from a product perspective and understand what customers are really after. Design experts, you know, usually a combination of these people who kind of need to get to the edge of this problem and figure out, well, first, is it technically feasible for us to do this thing? And then what, you know, what might it look like if we were to do something like this? Not designing it, not developing it, not executing any of that, you know, it's and sticking to kind of here's kind of the overview of what we think. And I think that's where it would differ from a waterfall project. But in that sense, what I'm saying is that not every piece of every project is necessarily agile. I think that the principles of agile and, you know, this principle of starting with big and making small and delivering along the way makes a lot of sense, as long as it's in the context of the bigger picture of things.
Yeah, I mean, what you're, I think what you're really highlighting there is the importance of vision and strategy, right? Sure. And Scrum and Kanban don't tell you anything about how to come up with a great vision for your product or how to come up with a great corporate strategy. They tell you how to optimize flow through a system and get, you know, individual pieces of work and pieces of customer value out to the customers as fast as possible. And that's awesome. We love that. We want to do that, and we want to get better and better at that. But if we don't know what the customer needs or what we're building for them, then it's pointless to be efficient at doing the wrong thing, right?
Yeah, so, sure.
No one wants to do that. So yeah, you're absolutely correct. You know, I think it's, you know, I wouldn't give too much credit to the term waterfall for that notion, but we need to still wrap our team processes within a sort of a corporate strategic purpose with a vision for this product, with, you know, user experience and user research on a regular basis. And those things can still be managed, you know, things like user research in particular, you can still do that in small chunks parallel to your sprints, you know, as you go through the development of a product. And you should still do it in iterations rather than kind of, you know, do it all up front and assume that that's exactly what customers would want a year later, right? But you still have to, you can iterate to nowhere if you don't have a good strategy or a vision in place. And so that is still really important to wrap all these things around with. I think that's a particular point of tension when you are trying to apply Agile, not only to non-software processes, but also just anything in a larger corporate environment, right? Because now you've got to sync across multiple teams and keep them aligned with each other to that vision.
Yeah. And I think that's sort of one of the, you know, one of the challenges in that that is really not necessarily kind of the mission of the stories that that a team would undertake. And you know, a lot of people have asked me kind of on the managerial side, well, if agile teams are self-managing, you know, I'm a manager, what do I do? Am I out of a job and that kind of thing? And you know, my response is, well, no, not at all. In fact, you know, your role is actually even more pivotal in that you're not necessarily telling the team exactly how they're supposed to work or what they get done because they're agreeing on that. But you need to kind of lift your head up when they're working heads down and figure out, well, how do these things fit in? And yeah, how do we communicate with other teams that are building things? And you know, if things are finishing at different times that are dependent on one another, how do we manage that from an interface perspective, and it's not, I'm not just talking about engineering and software. I'm talking about other things. Like if marketing, for example, is out of sync with what product is delivering, how do you manage that? And how do you deal with those things? Yeah. And so I think a lot of the managerial role in this is about that kind of coordination, mm-hmm. and management of that. And you know, my 10x consulting stuff was really about things like that that fall on the floor as teams sort of have their own missions and their own objectives.
Yeah,
it's you know, when things have to kind of mesh between teams, it's a big challenge. If nobody is really looking out for that sort of thing.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think that's, you know, that point of the importance of coordination and collaboration across teams, as well as that manager, that leader role, still providing a consistent vision across those teams, is so incredibly important. Key part of rolling out Agile in an enterprise or in non-software development projects, super important. So I think that's a great point for us to end on, David. Really appreciate your time in this conversation today. How can our listeners get in touch with you for more information, and where can they buy a copy of your book,
okay.
The Agile Enterprise?
Probably the best way to get in touch with me is through LinkedIn. Just look me up. I'd be happy to chat, and I welcome that. The book is available on Amazon. So if you search for Ash Agile Enterprise, you'll find something. And that's the easiest way to do it. I think it's available in paper and Kindle. So
perfect. And we'll be sure to include links to those in the show notes for this episode on scalingtechpod.com. So certainly encourage our listeners to go there and check out David's book and get the notes from this and all other episodes that we have, and make sure to give us a like and a follow on whatever platform you're following this episode of the Scaling Tech Podcast. Thank you so much, David, for joining me today. Really appreciate
it. Thanks, Aaron. Really appreciate it. It's a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Thank you.